Welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. Today we've got a bit of a special episode for those of you kind enough to post a question to the show about anything really, but most were about what we've covered so far. First, I'd like to give you a teaser of what's going to be coming up over the next few months in our episodes, as that's one of the most commonly asked questions I get. As I said, it's not been my intention to spend so long on the lead up to our first Prime Minister, but the context has been useful in my opinion. So we'll be beginning next time with a look at the revolutionary settlement of William and Mary, and then a quick look at Anne and a few important country and parliamentary reforms she put through, and then on to the Hanoverian succession, and then into Robert Walpole, our first Prime Minister. In between, we'll have a look at a few bonus episodes, including a discussion on the Magna Carta, and a deeper look into some special individuals, including a philosopher we've mentioned a little bit, and a composer who might sound familiar. Any guesses? Let me know. I've got some great guests coming on over the next couple of months, and some really interesting topics to be debated and talked about, which I hope you'll enjoy. Some of these include Jeremy Corbyn versus Boris Johnson, I'm looking to do an episode on Donald Trump, and then also one about Number 10 as a building. I'm really looking forward to these. So, let's get the mailbag out and get on to the questions submitted by you, the awesome listeners. So the first question comes from Pete, and it is, why haven't you talked about Scotland and Ireland in all of this? And it's a great question, and I was hoping really it wouldn't be asked. There's no excuse, to be honest. It's kind of been a mistake where I haven't really thought about Scotland and Ireland as I've been focusing on giving a general grounding to why the Prime Minister and the party system started. I'm not saying that they're not important, but they really don't play a huge role in this whistle-stop tour to our first leader. And that's really what these first couple of episodes are about, a prelude to the main course. I honestly believe there is a space in the podcast world for more coverage on this era in Ireland and Scotland. I'm not an expert on Scottish and Irish history, and although I've got a good grounding in British and English history, it probably would take me a good year to understand the full couple of hundred years back in each area to understand the religion, traditions, politics, and the people in a way that I give the flashes and the little dips into the past that I've done with our current series. I will try and cover more of Ireland and Scotland. I haven't been avoiding them on purpose. So the next question is from Jacob. It is, if Mary, the one who's married to William of Orange, was the rightful heir, why didn't she rule as queen and William as prince consort? So you're absolutely right. Mary was invited to take the throne, not William, after the Glorious Revolution. There's two reasons why he ended up being king as well. The first one was that William outright refused the role of consort. After all, he was the grandchild of King Charles I, and he refused to be tied by the apron strings in a similar fashion to that of Philip II of Spain, who is the first real consort that set this precedent, or the idea of consort. And secondly, Mary didn't want to rule alone. She didn't want the crown to be that of conquest, so that the child could be seen as a more accepting monarch they ruled together. The next question from James. What was quo warranto that James used, and how did the charter system work? This is really complicated, at least it was to me when I first started. Quo warranto is the medieval Latin for by what warrant. It was essentially a writ by which the king questioned the basis of a franchise, privilege, or liberty. What James did was find technicalities of how the boroughs had overstepped their charter rights and into the rights that the crown held. So Charles II, James II, abandoned the common charter process and forced town corporations to have their charters revoked. Obviously, many of these were ancient and given to the city centuries ago, and there had been a lot of blurring between the ancient town charters and the crown's rights. Both had evolved over time and for necessity. From here, they would then have to surrender the charter to the king for the crown to control it. The crown then issued a new charter for their existence as a corporation, which was necessary to have certain rights like electing leaders and collecting taxes. The king could then regulate the corporations, remove officers they didn't like without reason, and force the corporations to ask his consent on issues before making decisions. it was an important way to control certain important towns and cities by having those who serve you in positions of authority. It would be like the Queen now deposing the Mayor of London and replacing him with an ally of hers. And this is exactly what James did in London under Quororento in the 1680s. The next question from Phil. If James had accepted the forces from France, do you think it would have stopped the revolution? In short, no. Louis had just committed himself heavily in central Germany to the tune of 30,000 soldiers in order to secure the Rhine in the developing conflict that led to the 9 Years' War. If there was no conflict in Europe for Louis to be involved in, then absolutely yes. The French army was stronger in experience and numbers and had already crushed William and the Dutch a number of times whilst he was stadtholder. It's one of the most interesting parts of history of this time where we could have seen England as a French Catholic dominion if things had gone differently. The next question from Ryan. Do you have a favourite political joke? And I do. My favourite joke comes from the Monty Python song about Oliver Cromwell, and that is, the most interesting thing about King Charles I is that he was 5'6" tall at the start of his reign, but only 4'8" at the end of it. So Lisa asks, why do we still celebrate Guy Fawkes Night? In the words of Fiddler on the Roof, tradition, most likely. We burn bonfires now like we did then, but fireworks came later to where we are now. At the time, they celebrated the king not being blown up, but I think today we're more fickle. We like pretty firework displays. One tradition we seem to have lost in the UK, though, is Penny for the Guy. This was a tradition where children would build replicas of Guy Fawkes, like effigies, and they would wheel them around to their neighbours asking for money, usually so they could go and buy fireworks. The effigies would then be burnt later on in the night. And one from Antonia. Why don't you have Instagram and Snapchat? For Instagram, I don't know what photos I'd put up, except pieces of art from time to time and the portraits of prime ministers, which I don't think would really add anything to anyone's life. I don't have Snapchat because it terrifies me that I'm no longer a young person and am scuttling slowly towards my grave as technology flies past me. And a question now from Des. Does the phrase Whigs on the Green refer to the Whig Party? No, it doesn't. I thought this myself as someone whose father used to use it a lot when I was a kid. To fill in listeners who are unaware of the phrase, Whigs on the Green means there'll be trouble. So I used to get, Christopher, stop that, or there'll be Whigs on the Green. The Whig that is referred to is an actual Whig, not a member of the Whig Party. It's an Irish phrase that refers to when men in the 18th century used to have fights, that the blows would normally knock their wigs off onto the grass or the green. So there's been a fight. Kay has asked, who was the Prime Minister who fell off his chair and died? How did it kill him? So this refers back to our statistics episode from near the beginning. The Prime Minister who fell off the chair was Robert Gascoigne Cecil, or the Marquis of Salisbury. He served as Prime Minister under Queen Victoria. He was incredibly obese by the end of his life and had trouble breathing, so he took to sleeping in a chair. In August 1903, he fell from the chair, and with heart issues and blood poisoning, he died. Mike asks, what happened to the other guy in the Popish plot? So Israel Tong, the man who brought the manuscript to the king and presented Titus Oates to the court, died in 1680, before the end of the Popish plot. As a raving anti-Catholic, this was probably for the best, as I don't think he probably would have wanted to see the end of the trials and the persecution. There's a theory that J.P. Kenyon put forward that Tong honestly believed Titus Oates' claims and that he was somewhat duped into the plot along with everyone else. Chris Walker, a very, very good friend of mine, who has just got married earlier this week, so congratulations to him, has asked a question, which is, the kingdoms of England and Scotland shared the same monarch. How much power did Holyrood Parliament have? I reiterate my point on this earlier. Scotland has so much history that it deserves its own podcast for this period. So up to the 1690s, Scotland was run by the three estates. Now, anyone who's studied French history, yes, it is exactly the same as that before the French Revolution. The first estate was made of high-ranking clergy, including bishops and abbots. The second estate was nobility, parliamentary peers, and tenants in chief, who, instead of holding land for a bishop or nobility, held land directly for the king or a royal prince. The third estate were known as the Burgh Commissioners, and these were essentially elected representatives who came to Scottish Parliament, very similar to MPs. If you'd like to learn more about the feudal land tenure system or how land was owned and worked, there's a fantastic book by Susan Reynolds called Fiefs and Vassals. Interestingly, some of the feudal land tenure rights in Scotland weren't abolished until the year 2000. If anyone is interested, reach out to me, let me know, and I might do an episode on it. So you have these three estates, although I know some may argue there were two more estates made up of appointed office holders who were introduced under James I when he united England and Scotland, and the Shire Commissioners who were elected to vote in the Scottish Parliament. These Shire Commissioners were also similar to an English Member of Parliament. So by the time we get to the late 1600s, these three or five estates sat in two chambers, the Scottish Parliament and the sister advisory chamber known as the Convention of Estates, to make decisions, although the Convention of Estates lacked legislative power. Holyrood, which is another name for Scottish Parliament, was able to influence the Crown and did so various times throughout the previous centuries, probably most efficiently when they stopped their king, David II, remember Scotland is still its own country at this point, from seeking unification with England in the 14th century. We see at the point of the Glorious Revolution that the bishops were removed from the Scottish Parliament in 1690, which further pushed the monarch's influence out of Holyrood even more so. Again, apologies for the lack of Scotland. I will try to do more. And as he's just got married, I've got another question in here from Chris. And that is, what is your favourite Robert Walpole biography? I have to admit that the biographies out there on Walpole aren't amazing as the ones on other prime ministers like William Pitt the Younger, Gladstone and Robert Peel. If you're looking for information on his time as Prime Minister, then John Morley's is probably the best one out there. Personally, I've been using Betty Kemp's biography a lot with my preliminary research, as it reaches into his early years as well. So Will has asked, you were pretty vocal in the trade union debate. Are you a Tory? I wasn't really sure whether I'd answer this question, not because I'm closeted, but because for me it's not that simple. I have been a card-carrying Tory and worked hard to get MP James Brokenshire, who is now a cabinet member, to become elected when I was a teenager, but haven't been a member of for about 10, 12 years. I come from a heavily conservative safe seat in London, but were born to two parents who were of working class, who worked their way up into the middle class purely through hard work and their own merit. I voted Conservative, I voted Liberal Democrat, I voted Plaid Cymru, who are the Welsh Party, so it's not clean cut for me. I'm naturally right-leaning because I come from a family of Irish immigrants who work hard to make everything they have and believe in equal opportunity, not equal outcome. I vote on manifesto and remember the mistakes parties have made. The Liberal Democrat university fee increase didn't affect me, but it did affect my friends and will affect my children. The Tories' handling of Brexit has made me fall even further out of love with them, and I don't believe Labour is a party of progress or improvement, and would be hard-pushed to ever vote for them. UKIP and the alt-right terrify me, and I think there's a dangerous movement that disguises itself as patriotism, but in truth is no more than populism, xenophobia and racism. The last election was tough for me. I looked down at eight political parties on my ballot paper and spent 15 minutes standing in my community hall struggling over who to vote for. Not because I was torn between the two best, I was torn between the eight worst. I won't tell you how I voted, but I will tell you it was very similar to eating a cold kebab. Disappointing. The fact is, there is no political party that I return to because I don't feel anyone represents me well enough to deserve my loyalty. And I think a lot of people feel like that. I'm pretty much what Britain is on average. Naturally right-leaning, with a love of our public sector, and irritated by incompetent politicians who don't serve their constituents as well as they should. What I will say is that I'm not here to put a spin on the history. I'm here to tell you what happened in as much detail as I can. And when we do debates, I will bring someone on who disagrees with me and is the different side of the issue to give that balance. I'm not here to push anyone's agenda or manifesto. I'm here to have interesting new conversations about politics and history with very different people discussing it in a most wide-ranging way as possible. So Emma has asked, you mentioned last episode about the Grand Tour. What was it? Yes, apologies for the lack of context on this. I can tell you it has nothing to do with Jeremy Clarkson. If you were a young, rich, European man, although a small number of women did take part, you would take a trip, usually with a chaperone of a family member or a priest, around Europe. Now, these chaperones were known as bear leaders and were supposed to act as a teacher, a protector, a guide, and a friend on the journey. It was popular in the 16 and 1700s and was seen as a rite of passage or a cultural awakening, usually through France, Italy, and other European countries. Grand tourists were looking to visit the centre of the Renaissance, which was coming to the end in Europe. Now, John Locke was a big fan of travel as a way of broadening your horizons, and travelling to see new things and experience new cultures began to really take prominence in the 17th century. There was a rough standard route followed for both Catholic and Protestant travellers, which was from Dover to Calais in France, and then to Paris or Basel in Switzerland, where you would then travel to Geneva. Both routes would then follow the road to Italy, where you would see Turin, Milan, Florence, Pisa, Bologna, and Venice. From Venice, the young elite would go to Rome, seeing the Colosseum and the glorious Baroque architecture. The journey would then usually conclude in Naples. That was the tour for the 1600s, but later on in the 1700s and beginning of the 1800s, the trips would sometimes go to Pompeii and Mount Vesuvius, which had been discovered around the 1700s, as well as boating journeys to Sicily, Malta, and Greece. Holland, Flanders, Austria, and Germany were also features on some grand tours. So Steve asks, why did the Anglo-Dutch Wars happen? Okay, so this all stems from control of seas and the trade. It started in the 1650s, where the English banned the Dutch from involvement in the English sea trade. We're seeing the beginning of the British Empire and colonies in this time. Both the Dutch and the English were made for it. The Dutch East India, Dutch West India, and British East India companies were the three biggest joint stock trading companies in Europe, and their nations essentially fought throughout the second half of the 17th century for control of the trade routes and waterways to the New World and the Mughal Empire in India. After the Third Anglo-Dutch War, the English and Dutch Republic became allied for over a century before the start of the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War in 1780. But I won't say any more than that now until we get to the infamous Lord Frederick North. James has asked, what happened to Judge Jeffreys? Now, Judge Jeffreys was the infamous Chief Justice who oversaw the Bloody Assizes, and he was captured whilst trying to escape during the Glorious Revolution following James II to France. He was recognised by a survivor of the slayings and the mob arrested him. He was locked up in the Tower of London and he died of kidney failure whilst residing in the Tower in 1689. Danielle from the Monarchs and Malarkey podcast, a very good podcast, you should go and check them out, has asked, who do you think has been the most effective Prime Minister in regards to actually doing long-term good for non-nobility? I talk very often about politicians and statesmen, whether politicians are looking at the next election, statesmen are looking at the next generation. And I'm torn on this one, so I'll mention a few. There's Robert Peel, who created the police force and repealed the Corn Laws that had starved many poor and contributed to the death toll in the Irish potato famine. He also repealed the last laws on Catholic discrimination, and if you can't wait to get there, the Age of Victoria podcast are doing it right now in their politically focused episodes on the early 19th century. Clement Attlee has to be up there. The creation of the NHS is probably one of the greatest gifts that a Prime Minister has given to the United Kingdom. I'd argue Margaret Thatcher is up there too, giving a generation of lower and middle class people the ability to buy their own homes. Free markets allow for privatisation of a number of companies that overall drove competition and prices down for the average person. Of course, this is very conscientious. I'd love to hear your views on who you think makes the top of that list. So a second one from Danielle from the Monarchs and Malarkey podcast. Do you think the system of MPs and one Prime Minister is currently useful or outdated? Is the system perfect? No. Is it better than most other systems around the world? I'd say so. The idea of a single figurehead to lead the country, I think, is important. MPs, in theory, represent the area that they come from and come to Parliament to represent their needs and their views. A parliamentary member has four masters: the country, his constituents, his party, and his conscience. I think far too many don't think about their constituents and don't value that model of trusteeship that Edmund Burke wrote about in the 1700s. I think Brexit has shone a light on the flaws of our system, where we cannot agree in the elected house how to proceed. I mean, if we didn't have Boris and his plan, would we have a direction right now? Over the last 3 years, no vote has been successfully passed on the EU with a convincing majority. MPs have, in many cases, disregarded the constituents' vote to leave in the referendum and voted against the European Union exit at every turn. Now, there's something the average Briton hates. It's someone in a suit and a position of authority who thinks they know better than you. And it's because of this that we're going to see some real punishment handed out in the next general election. We saw it in the European election, and we're going to see it where it actually matters at the next general election. There's an alternative school of thought that MPs should be delegates, bringing their views and the vote of their constituency to Parliament instead of their own thoughts and views. So I had two more questions by listeners who didn't leave their names, but we'll go through them anyway. The first one was, why was it called the Great Fire and the Great Plague? Well, mainly because of their size. 13,000 houses were destroyed in London during the fire, and London lost 15% of its population during the plague. Most of the dead were buried in a town not far from where I was born, called Blackheath, so aptly named, as the commons outside the main town are filled with the buried corpses of victims of the Black Death. Today, you still cannot develop on those commons. Interestingly, I was doing some reading and thought I'd add a bit more information about why the fire spread so far. The first reason was they were all wooden houses, and there's lots of flammable materials, such as oils and gunpowders, were stored quite close together in warehouses. Because they were wooden framed houses, they collapsed outwards, which spread the fire even further. The fire also started in the middle of the night, so not many people realised. Samuel Pepys, for example, was woken by his maids to talk about the fire, but he went back to bed because he didn't think it was a big deal. Many people did that. And the other thing was, in great fires, one of the tricks that they used was to blow up houses along the way so that the fire didn't have any more fuel to carry it further. But this decision was delayed by the Mayor of London at the time. The second question was, did Samuel Pepys' house actually burn down? And no, it didn't. Not in the Great Fire of London in 1666 anyway. I can't give you a source because I read it somewhere and I lost it, but I'm pretty sure that I read that the house did burn down in the 1680s in an unrelated fire. Don't trust me on it, as I spent ages looking for the source and couldn't find it. But if you can find it, please let me know, because it's absolutely driven me crazy. The next question is from Sean, and he said, have you watched the miniseries The First Churchills and Charles II, The Power and the Passion? Do they present a faithful image of the period? And I have to admit, I hadn't seen these before you mentioned them. I've watched a few episodes of The First Churchills, and to be honest, it's probably the best show that's made about John and Sarah Churchill. If you want to know the facts, this is a good series. It's quite low budget, and I think it's probably a bit too favourable of John Churchill. I prefer The Favourite as a look into their character and hunger for power, but even then, we need to take that with a pinch of salt. Charles II, The Power and the Passion is an okay representation of the time, in my opinion. I think Parliament is a lot more tame than it would have been, especially when Charles II dissolved Parliament for trying to remove James II as his heir. But if you've seen The Borgias or The Tudors, they're as accurate a portrayal as those shows are to their eras. Our final question comes from Michelle, and that is, could you please give a brief overview of who was eligible to serve in the House of Commons and how they were elected? How broad was the franchise at this time? Were there competitive elections? And this is a brilliant question for us to end on. So to be an MP, as far as I'm aware, backed up by a lot of research, could be any British male at the time. It was circumstance that would hold you back. If you were poor, you were unlikely to have the means to take a few weeks off from your small holding and campaign your constituency. We haven't really talked about it yet, but most seats were controlled by the landed gentry, who basically told their tenants to vote for them. We talk about rotten boroughs when we get to Walpole. So competitive elections? No, not really. We don't really start to see these until the Reform Acts of the 1800s. It wasn't really until the actions of John Wilkes that we will get to at the later part of the 1700s that anyone suggested parliamentary reform. He's the real first commoner without a station that is elected to Parliament. I mean, there were soldiers who became MPs, but they'd been promoted up the social class and generally behaved in front of the majority of landed gentry in Parliament. Interestingly, if you are a Lord now, you must renounce your Lord title to serve in the House of Commons. This happened due to the actions of Tony Benn that we will be getting to in about 250 years. Another example is Conservative peer Baroness Moberick, who has been disqualified from the House of Lords as she's currently serving as a member of European Parliament. So essentially, one at a time. In regards to the franchise, which refers to who could vote, this was complicated and before the Reform Act hadn't really changed since the medieval period. Women, of course, are nowhere near getting the vote, and the conversations aren't even being had at this time. However, at this point, you could still technically vote, as long as you met the male criteria. But this was rare. Hilariously, the 1832 Reform Act actually took the vote away from women for the first time in history, legally. Each country had different election qualifications, as too did the different counties and boroughs. You didn't register to vote either. You had to prove you had the right to vote at that election, and this wasn't by secret ballot either. They didn't come in until 1872. So if you were a tenant farmer and voted against the Lord owning your land, well, you'd probably be looking at relocation soon after the election. A lot of elections were uncontested as well, as many nobles saw them as family property and would be passed down through family lineage. As I said, many boroughs and counties had ancient ways of voting MPs, much like the corporations we talked about earlier. And to vote where you were allowed to in a contested election, you needed to have a certain value of property. But this varied between boroughs and constituencies. We'll be talking about this a lot more very soon. And that is all the questions from this mailbag, but I'll do another one soon, so get them in now, nice and early. I also like to thank all those who left reviews on the podcast, and I think it's only fair to thank some of you on air. So, M. Gerrish, which I believe is Michelle, who left us a question, she has left us a review saying, an Anglophile's delight. This is an excellent podcast for those who want to delve into history and or current situation of British prime ministerships. Is that even a word? Great presentation and detail. So thank you very much, Michelle. The next one's from Thorin0724. Very informative podcast. Though it's only a few episodes in thus far, I feel like I've already learned a great deal from the Number 10 podcast. Highly recommended for fans of history podcast. Can't wait to hear what Chris has in store as we move ahead. So thank you very much, Thorin. Then Mariap 514 has said, educational and calming. Chris has a natural podcasting voice and tells engaging and interesting stories. The kind of podcast I put on when I'm cozy in my apartment with a cup of tea or a glass of wine. Well, that's perfect. That's exactly what I'm going for. So thank you very much, Mariap. And then quote unquote guilty has left a review saying, awesome. Fascinating and well researched. Love how much time and energy is going into this. Absolutely, I aim to please. So thank you very much. And then we have one from the Monica Malarkey podcast. Again, a great podcast. Go and listen, which is very educational. I am a huge history lover, especially British history. I've learned a lot of details I wasn't familiar with by listening to this show. Chris is sincere in his delivery and earnest in his endeavours to teach you something new. So thank you very much, Danielle, and all the team at the Monarchs Malarkey podcast. And then one from NC Bernie, 64. Great podcast, very informative and helpful. I'm all about history podcasts, and this one definitely doesn't disappoint. So thank you very much, NC Bernie. There's been loads more, so apologies if I haven't mentioned you. I've mentioned a few more this time because I haven't done one yet, but I'll try and do more and more. So if you haven't left a review yet, head to the iTunes store, leave me a review, and you'll get a shout out on air. I also want to talk to you about an email that I've had from one of our listeners, Michelle, who has done the triple this time. She's had a question, she's had a review read, and she's had an email read. And I just want to dive into what she said in this email. As an American, I sometimes get lost in the weeds of current British politics. Your latest episode had a lot of mystifying references, but I'll gamely hang on. The trade union episode was great, except I kept shouting into my headphones about the whole union employment situation is so different in the US. It was mentioned in passing, but a huge issue for unions now is to fight cutbacks or even the elimination of health insurance benefits. Most of the recent strikes have been about the issue, as well as harsh working conditions in places like Amazon warehouses. You folks in the UK are so lucky to have a stable government healthcare system and an assurance that government will regulate abuses. Not so here, especially under the Trump administration. My thought is the government oversight is the best, as it expresses the desire of the whole society for fair and safe workplaces, but lacking that, unions are essential. Yes, there are abuses, but times have radically changed in the past 30 years, primarily due to globalisation and regulation. Anyway, give my fond regards to Ryan and tell him he has a fan in the US. Also, thank you for converting currency amounts into modern terms when talking about historical events. It makes it so much easier to grasp the impact of the spending. And thank you, Michelle, for the email. And there's 2 points that are raised there. The union debate, again, I've done a lot of reading since then. And it always happens when I have a conversation with Ryan. I go away, I read more, I learn more. And a lot of the times I change my opinion on things as well. We will be doing more episodes with Ryan about globalization, about Amazon especially, which doesn't seem like a fair deal for the workers, but we'll be doing those chats in the coming months. And again, it is a different system in the US compared to the UK. I recently watched the new Michael Moore documentary Fahrenheit 11/9 with Mrs. Number 10 the other night, and it was shocking how some of these abuses of workers are going on and kind of just allowed. So we'll have a debate on that very soon. But thank you very much for the email. And if you want to email in and tell me your thoughts and have that conversation with me, let me know. If you want to call in to the podcast and do a little chat episode, a little 5, 10 minute or 20 minute thing, please do that. We can arrange it. I love speaking to people. I've got a really good setup via Skype for doing calls in, as I've practiced earlier today with one of our episodes that we recorded with Jack Brown for the number 10, the building episode. So that's going to be coming out in the next couple of weeks. I'm really excited about it. It was a very, very good conversation. But that's everything from this episode. I hope you don't feel that you're missing anything because it's not a history episode or a politics episode. But I think these mailbag episodes are really cool. I certainly enjoy them. And I hope you did too. So thank you very much for listening. And I will see you next time. Take care.